Tape 2, Side 2, continuing.
Of course, the important thing about the whole thing was not only getting it together, but in order to continue operation, we had to raise money, and I raised something like $1 million from these various organizations. I even had the Mobil Oil Company was a contributor. Can you believe that?
Yes.
They had a lot of contributors. Anyhow, that kept me busy for a while.
And then what? Does it still...
Is it still in operation in a very, very low-key way? It was my intention when I did it. I thought that what we would do is to be a short-lived organization that would operate for something like 5 years, hopefully, until there was a... until there was realization of what the problems were, and hopefully... And then I thought it could be discontinued. But it's still hanging on. And the office was in Washington. We did a lot of lobbying. We had a conference here in Pittsburgh. There were conferences in other part of the country. We tried to organize. We did, as a matter of fact, have a federation committee that was put together for energy awareness. I mentioned to you last time, at least when you were left, there was Admiral Zumwalt.
Yeah, that's one of my questions. We were going to discuss his character.
Well, first of all, what happened was... when we got organized, Chuck Peabody was our interim president. But then we had to have a more permanent president, so Zumwalt had just retired from the Navy, and we thought that was a prestigious name, and so we recruited him. And I think I mentioned to you, Zumwalt turned out to be person who, in a sense, tried to use the organization for his own purposes rather than to do what it is that we wanted to do. He traveled and he spoke and he did all these things, but basically he was trying to further Admiral Zumwalt's own agenda. And one of the things that he did was, I mentioned to you, was he got the people who were associated with the Navy. One was was under him another admiral, or a vice admiral, who he put in charge of publicity, and it turned out this fellow had an association with a company in California that was a printing company and a publicity company. So it turned out that we got all kinds of printing and done by way out in California without getting any bids. Then there were sons of admirals and so on. So it turned out to be a messy situation, and we...
Pure nepotism.
Yeah. And finally what happened is we had a showdown. We had a meeting, and I.W. Abel was at... No, it wasn't Abel. It was... president of the AFL-CIO in Washington. He was on the board at the time. He's currently president. The name escapes me at the moment. And there was Bob Nathan and Chuck Peabody and myself and Admiral Zumwalt and maybe another. Oh, Hans Bethe was there as well. And the I had objected strenuously to what was going on at the time, and there were these recriminations back and forth. And Zumwalt laid it on the line. He says, either I had to go or he was going. And the result was the board voted to have him go.
Yep.
So there was a lot of tumult about that at the time. There was an article in the AAAS magazine, Science, about it, which was totally distorted as usual.
As usual.
Anyhow, that was fun. Then we had a another person, Cecily Selby, who was the former president of Girl Scouts of America. And she stayed with us, I think, for about a year. She was also on the board of RCA. And she turned out to be a very paranoid type of person, very defensive and difficult to work with. So she went, and then we finally got a fellow named Elihu Bergman, who was the Harvard population studies. He did population studies for Harvard. And he's still, I think, associated with the organization. And he stayed. It was, we had, I think I mentioned, we had a national conference where we had the principal executives of various energy companies and Governor, well, it was Vice President Rockefeller at the time, was one of our speakers and guest. And as a matter of fact, I still have the program of that conference. I have a letter from Rockefeller thanking me. That kept me busy for quite some time.
Yes. What are the dates for this?
I recall it. It was, I started working on this thing in 73 or 74, 73. It took a year or more to get organized. And I had to get, what happened was that you build one from the other. I got, Burnham, who was then the president of Westinghouse, to introduce me to I.W. Abel. And then there were additional introductions all the way. And
one-on-one thing.
Exactly. And each one tended to introduce me. And, you know, when Abel was on, that meant that the fellow from Washington who was the electrical, the National Secretary of the Electrical Workers got on, and then Evelyn Dubrow got on, and so on. So it was a matter of building step at a time. And I recruited Hans Bethe over the telephone, and he agreed to do that. And we had a an organization meeting in Washington. John Schiff, incidentally, who was the head of Kuhn Loeb at the time, was on the board of Westinghouse, so I got the introduction again through them.
Mm-hmm. We come down to the it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Well, it's both, I guess. But who you know is extremely important.
Yeah. Fred Forscher's paper comes out regularly. Is that having to do with this?
No, that's his own paper, and I must say he's been very, works at it very assiduously, and has some very interesting stuff.
Often to some less consequential things, just for the record, involvement in things with health and fitness. This was one of the questions that Eleanor had mentioned.
Yeah. I was asked about 8 years ago to to help a professor from the Technion in Israel who came here for a liver transplant. And I didn't know the man at the time, but he lived in the same apartment house that a cousin of ours lived, and our cousin called up and said this man was a professor of lightning, as it turned out. He was a professor in the School of Architecture, and his specialty was lighting.
I see.
Anyhow, we got involved. I got involved as a result of that in transplant situation. And when Professor Naaman was here for his transplant, he was operated on by a team under Starzl. But the head surgeon at the time was a Egal Kamm, K-A-M-M, who was a K-A-M, I guess it is, who was a surgeon from the Rambam Hospital in Israel, who was here for training for a couple of years. And he indicated he wanted to go back to Israel to start a transplant program, but he was having difficulty doing that because there wasn't enough money. So at that time we had we started a drive at the locally in the Technion for some engineering program. So what I did was I convinced our then president, who was Bud Morris, locally, to change the nature of the program completely so that what we would have is a research and training program at the medical school of the Technion, which would be associated with the Rambam Hospital, is adjacent to the Technion Medical School and serves as the principal hospital of the Technion. So what we did was we raised money. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the most, if not the most successful campaign we had. We raised about $600,000 in a matter of 6 months. And people obviously became quite excited about the whole thing. And the idea was that we would have a training program at the Technion, and it would be carried through at the Rambam Hospital, where they would actually do the transplants. And we also arranged for the American Friends of Rambam to raise money. So there was a considerable amount of money that was raised, in excess of $1 million. Actually, our goal was, I think, about $1.5 million. And a lot of that was, in fact, raised. We had I organized a mission. We had about 29 people who went to Israel from Pittsburgh on that mission, and that was for the dedication of the transplant institute. And there was a ceremony, and the dedication not only at the Technion but also at the Rambam Hospital, and then it turned out that there was a tremendous amount of politics associated with it, because there was a physician at the hospital in Tel Aviv, Beilinson Hospital in Tel Aviv, who had started a kidney transplant program in Beilinson Hospital, and he insisted that he was going to have all of the transplant programs in Israel. And so he did everything in his power to kill it. And as a matter of fact, it turned out that he withheld organs. You know, there were a lot of people. One of the problems, of course, is that the availability of organs. So the issue is, where are you going to get them? Well, as you know, there are a lot of road accidents in Israel. So there were considerable number of donors. And these kidneys came from such donors. The difference between the liver and the kidney is that you could take kidneys from cadavers, but you had to take livers from people who were brain dead. We're still functioning, but we're brain dead. When I say functioning, the bodies were simply, the heart was beating. So, about, my recollection was at that time I interviewed the physician there. His name was Zaki Shapiro.
Familiar.
And he told me that they did around 95 transplants of kidneys. About half of those transplants came from brain-dead people. So that would mean that there were organs obviously available for other purposes, but they did not supply those organs to other hospitals. That was really a criminal, I think. Yeah. That guy should have been put in jail. In any case, I got involved with a minister of health who was a woman at the time. Her name was Alma Slino. And as it turned out, she was very political. She was with the Labor Party, very political, and I think very ineffective. And one of the things that, of course, should have been done is to have a program where there would be a fair allocation of the organs. And it had to be a nationally supervised program. And she didn't do anything about that. And there were a number of conversations. I went on television in Israel, had an interview. I tried to do my best to see what we could do to get around all of the red tape. And it turned out to be an impossible situation, and Yigal Kam finally, in disgust because he couldn't get anything done, came back to the States, and he is now so he's back. It's unfortunate he's back here. Now there is a transplant program that was actually started in Israel at the Hadassah Hospital, and they are doing some transplantation of kidneys and Rambam. Of course, they also have another program. They tried liver transplant at Beilinson Hospital, and it turned out to be a disaster. They tried to, and then they got some German doctors who, it just didn't work. But they are getting started now. There are more people who are in training and actually who have come to Pittsburgh, and also to the Mayo Clinic for training. So eventually, I think they'll have a full-fledged program. It was my impression that it would be not only helpful for Israel, because basically this would be, I thought that it would help to establish relations with the Arab countries, because there are a lot of Arabs who come here, and it would be a lot easier to go to Israel for there are plenty of Arabs who go to the hospitals in Israel from Saudi Arabia and other places, Jordan, other places. And I thought this would help cement relations and also actually bring in a considerable amount of cash into the country. But they didn't see it that way. I wrote a letter. I spent a tremendous amount of effort on that. Today, we have other problems locally because there are a lot of Israelis who are coming to Pittsburgh for transplants. There's one waiting for a lung transplant. Been waiting for about 10 months now. There's another woman who was still in the hospital. She's been here a year now. She was 34 when she came, and she has a couple of kids. And she had a complete, her whole digestive system was transplanted. And hopefully she'll get better, but she's having a rough time. So I'm hoping that what we will be able to do is to get some assistance from the federations around the country, because I think it's really unfair for the burden, just because people come to Pittsburgh, for the burden to rest on Pittsburgh alone. And it seems to me that the federations around the country should really contribute toward this. So I've talked to Howard Rieger. So far there hasn't been very much action. What I wanted to do also, I'm pushing for, is a guardianship program through the Jewish Family and Children's Service. And so that's...
What do you mean by that?
Well, when the people come here to Pittsburgh, many of them don't speak the language, or if they speak, they really can't express themselves well. They don't know the ropes. They don't know how to get around the hospital. They don't know how to speak to the doctors. They need an ombudsman, for one thing. They need somebody to help them with all sorts of things, but particularly from the standpoint of money. You see, what happens when somebody comes in from Israel, the hospital has indicated they want so much down. For example, when this woman came in for the multiple organ transplant, the hospital insisted that there be $472,500, I think it was, down before she would even get on the list. And then they wanted another $71,000 for the physicians. So they raised a lot of money in Israel as a result of the television and letter writing campaigns and so on. So they came up with, and the insurance company paid for about, the Israeli insurance company, health insurance company, paid for about $200,000, I think, of the total. The rest, most of the rest came from Israel, and we raised some money here in town. We raised about $10,000 here. There was an ad that was put into the paper. Now that money goes directly into the bank account of the hospital. So even if a patient is here over a period of time, and the money is utilized over a period of time, whatever the interest is that is collected doesn't go to the patient, it goes to the hospital. Furthermore, the hospital draws on it as they wish. That money is in their hands, and they deplete those resources quite rapidly. As a matter of fact, I did a study in the hospital, and they found out that many of the services that they perform are actually horrendous. I have numbers. I compared these with the Shadyside Hospital, and I compared them with the hospital in Denver, and it's incredible what the differences are. In many cases, for example, the cost of the same service here is twice as what it is in Denver. It's It's and I also got information about what it costs to actually do the, for example, if they do a test in one of the laboratories in at Crespi. I actually have the cost of what it is, including their profit and overhead and so on. And it turns out, in some cases, the hospital charges the patient 10 to 30 times what it actually costs them. Their excuse, of course, is that what they want to do is to they have to pay for indigent patients who get free care, and
right.
They have to pay for medical students, they have to pay for research and all that sort of thing.
But it doesn't have to come from that.
That's precisely the point. It doesn't have to come from the individual self-pay patient, or from, for that matter, from Blue Cross and Blue
That's
Shield.
Right.
Those are separate things. The indigent patient is a ward of the community, not a ward of a particular individual. The research and development in medicine is not only part of communities. It should be a community responsibility, actually a national community responsibility. Which
and
it is
to a great degree through the National Science Foundation.
Yes, and to a large degree
That's
there
right.
is. They are funded, and it
sure.
should be the drug companies and so on. It shouldn't come out of the pockets of the self-paid patient. So they are really, I think that from a health point of view, the one of the principal problems in the cost of health care is what the hospitals themselves are doing. They are just gouging the patients. So anyhow, what we've been trying to do is to arrange for the Jewish Family and Children's Service to have a fund, to arrange for the funds to be under their aegis rather than under
them.
And they would dispense them based on the bills that the hospital sent and which were then examined by an appropriate, knowledgeable person who would be able to say, yes, this is fair, this is not. In many cases, there are errors that are made in the bills. It's just absolutely incredible.
We've had enough experience, unfortunately, to substantiate that.
So, I've had a hard time getting that going, but what's happened is the JF&CS is doing it on a sort of an individual basis. They're not doing anything about money at this point because, as it turns out, there are people who are fearful that we may get involved too much, that we would have, they would be held responsible, that is, the organization would be held responsible, and all that sort of thing. So it's not easy. So we do what we can to help to the extent that we can within the framework of the operations today. And I was hoping, as a matter of fact, that by this time we would be able to get the assistance and the support of the Jewish Healthcare Foundation. Karen has been helpful, but of course she isn't in a position to do everything. I think what we desperately need in this community is a healthcare alliance of users, not of the doctors, not of the insurance companies, but the people.
End of tape 2, side 2, to be continued on tape 3.
Or through a separate organization that we started with the assistance of the Federation, that we might be able to start such an alliance so that elderly people and people who are not associated with any particular company at any time would be able to get insurance at a much lower rate as a huge group, and that group would then be able to negotiate